Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the podcast Postcritical Psychogeographies from Weak Resistance to Weak Avant-Garde. I have the pleasure and honor to have a fantastic guest here with me, Professor Angela Dimitrakaki. I almost said Davies for some reason, but no, Angela Dimitrakaki is here with us today, and she is the Professor of Contemporary Art History and Theory at the University of Edinburgh. She was Program Director in Modern and Contemporary Art History, Curating and Criticism, and she's current... She is now on the leave and working on the book Feminism, Art, Capitalism, which will be published soon by Pluto Press, as I recall. She also published the books Gender, Artwork and the Global Imperative, Art and Globalization from Postmodern Science to Biopolitical Arena. She has also co-edited the volumes Depression Era, A Collective Lens in the Age of Crisis with Alex Stecker, and Economy, Art Production and the Subject in the 21st Century with Kirsten Lloyd, and many other books. She's been also co-editor. I mean, she is on board of the she co-edited the third text special issue on social reproduction and art, and also Anti-Fascism Art Theory with Harry Weeks, in which I had the pleasure to participate. And also, you are connected with the historical materialism, but I can't remember in which way. Can you help me here?
Thank you very much, Siva. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you.
I used to be an editor, one of the editors, for many years back, around 2000 when the journal was starting. Okay. And since I took the post in Edinburgh and obtained a child,
yes,
I had to downsize. So I've been a corresponding editor.
Mm-hmm. Of the historical materialism publications or journal.
No, the journal, but I've been involved also in the conference through the Marx Feminist School.
I did.
And started at some point. And yeah, so.
Yeah, because you are always very present in the... Yes, you are always incredibly present in the historical materialism conferences, especially in London and in Athens. So this is where I see you most often, and I'm very happy for that. And I wanted to go to, I invited you because I think historical materialist and feminist perspective on avant-garde is an incredibly important one. So that's the main reason why I wanted to invite you. But another one is obviously that you are an expert in art theory and also art history. So I think that this conjunction of historical materialism, art history and theory and feminism is something we need very much today in the time of the appropriations of different kinds of the artworks. So my first question is, what is your first association with the avant-garde? Do you have a definition or favorite examples?
Okay, I'll start with my first association and then move on to the possible definition. So as an undergraduate back in Athens, I was studying archaeology and art history. And the reason I eventually turned to art history was a module on the Russian, later on Soviet avant-garde. And, you know, when you're young, contrary to what people believe, the system really wants to get hold of you, to direct you to the reproduction of the same, but, you know, with a bit of a generational twist. So for a 20-year-old, as I was then, to look ahead to a capitalist life, to hear suddenly that the world was truly different for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And some other young people thought of new forms, new words that they had invented, and because they thought they were part of a new era, of a revolution for humanity. That was quite something for me. It was a shock to my system. So I started already from my undergraduate studies. I couldn't think of something else apart from the
avant-garde. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because the tutor of that module, she was herself a heroic being, okay? One who had opposed right-wing CIA-installed junta in Greece at the time, like in the late 70s and she had late 60s sorry the 70s and she took part in the student uprising. There was a student movement against the junta, and she took part in the student uprising. She had her legs crossed by the junta tanks.
Terrible.
And this is the person who taught
okay
the history of the avant-garde to me. So that was
super inspiring.
I became invested. And I wanted to become a historian of the avant-garde. And to kind of like elucidate for myself and for others what this thing was, its contradictions.
It was work hard to see back then in my 20s that this moment had passed in spice
and that for my generation, it wasn't possible to have an avant-garde without a social revolution of the greatest magnitude, and this was not the kind. And now to the definition that you asked, the definition of the avant-garde, for me, would go something like this. An exploratory imaginary dedicated to thinking, but also giving form to humanity's first self-determined history, what I would call the revolutionary process and its abstract. So for me, because I know the word avant-garde is used in all sorts of ways, the avant-garde is not an unfocused experimentation, a kind of like open becoming that it can go whichever way.
Yeah.
But rather, I think it's centered on the dialectic of political and aesthetic judgment, which I see as central to the operation of an avant-garde.
Mm-hmm.
There's a problem even with this definition. I can say kind of the problem we think of the historical avant-garde, because in this category, the historical avant-garde, we now find things like the Italian futurists who were so connected to fascism.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, there is reactive avant-garde all over the place, conservative avant-garde. We have seen it now in Poland with the fascist director of the CCA in Warsaw, who was exhibiting fascist artists, you know, people who were sentenced in their countries, in their home countries, for promotion of fascism. And this director of the CCA in Warsaw was bringing those artists here in the last decades, you know, in the last decade, sorry, and exhibiting them. So we have seen the sort of reemergence of the conservative avant-garde, because he was also very sharp on like avant-garde stuff. He wasn't an idiot. He was totally competent with avant-garde, but he was picking the fascist hats, so that was really scary.
I think it's up to art history. I think art history, contemporary art history, has a role to play here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we can go back to the historical avant-garde and ask for this formalist approach to be removed.
Mm-hmm.
So that what you call conservative, which is far worse actually, because it's fascist, can be removed from the definition of the avant-garde. I think it's a much more narrow
definition. For me, the good or the useful correction on our thinking of avant-garde comes actually from feminism and queer studies. So when feminism makes the claim for women and other marginalized and excluded groups to join in the art field, the art production, then they demand also very often a transformation of the mode of production, of the mode of not only being an artist, but also of creating the art work. And for instance, it has implications for participatory works, because then the context of care comes in and being together in solidarity, which is, I think, important addition and a quite leftist one. I mean, we can imagine also conservative or fascist solidarity, unfortunately. So that is a problem. But I believe that if we look into the form, then this form not being coercive and the form being sort of directed at, you know, egalitarianism allows maybe to make the definition a little bit less wide, as you demanded, and perhaps excluding the fascist tendencies.
I think that a feminism is not one necessarily. And I think that we have artists who self-identify as feminist or queer, which is something else, but if they don't necessarily want to overthrow the system, you know,
it doesn't end well.
They can operate very comfortably with
it. I mean, I was comparing recently.
I see this somehow connected to anything close to the avant-garde.
I have a useful comparison, I think, for this point that you make. I was comparing recently Marina Abramović and Marta Rosler and the ways how they inhabited the MoMA New York when they were invited to be, you know, to exhibitions there. And then we have Marina Abramović with this turbo monumental kind of tsarist style, you know, expression of her, you know, of her royal role. I compare it to beatification, you know, because all her miracles were brought in, you know, all the miracles she did over her lifetime, which were, you know, her performances, her art is for me very interesting and it is important as avant-garde. However, the thing she did at MoMA was, I think, in many ways, an opposition to what I would call an avant-garde approach. And then we have Marta Rosler, who puts a garage sale inside the New York MoMA. So she transforms, you know, the entire institution that usually deals with like market value and value production, augmentation of the ego also and of the status of the artist. And she didn't, she failed, I'm using the notion of fail, to say that she failed at becoming the queen of the MoMA New York. And therefore she opposed the opportunities that neoliberal economy and art economy gave her by precisely refusing to bring her artworks and increase their values, to bring her magnitude. And, you know, she was not a narcissistic ego in this meta-monumental garage sale. So she, in many ways, rejected the opportunities. And I think she didn't capitalize. I have read many reviews of her show. And they were very critical because they were accusing her of, like, doing something she has done for 20 years now, you know, garage sale, nothing new. And I was like, okay, but we are not chasing the new. We are now, I mean, she is now installing a garage sale in the New York MoMA, which makes a whole world of difference from her doing the garage sales in some small galleries in San Diego or something, with all due respect to those exhibitions. Because they were valuable from another point of view. But entering a garage sale, even 30 years after she started doing garage sales in the New York MoMA, I think has a performative value, which is not to be overpriced, which is incredibly huge to me, which is basically that it contradicts all those opportunities the neoliberal market economy gives her. And then she's like, no, thank you very much. I'll just do my garage sale. I'll invite people from Brooklyn and whoever else can come. And of course, there was a price for the ticket. The prices of the merchandise were not super low. So this can be maybe made into a critical point. However, nevertheless, she presented the MoMA. She sort of made a slapped, I think, the New York MoMA and said, like, you know what? You're not so important. And I think to say this to such a major institution is actually, it requires some guts, I think. And it's also, it allows us to see this institution as something that was created, that is not like a obvious element of the world ontology. It has been created and it has been, it has become this central institution. And we can also rethink all the problems that come with such a monopolization of the spotlight and of the economy and of the capital. By those major institutions. So I'm sorry for speaking so long.
I think Abramović and Rosler, they have very different histories. MoMA, which should be, you know, the topic of discussion on its own. I mean, I don't think an institution like this, especially now, can accommodate a little bit linked to anything that it would be leaving. Avant-garde for various reasons. It's a repository, you know, like of things. So
I would say it's a very vicious repository because it totally monopolized the scene and it became really like the central place for the world.
Yeah, it's not alone. I think kind of represents a whole range of institutions which are around for a long time. They represent certain core links to the system that dominates us and is not even up to the individual institutions anymore to kind of break from that. I think it's impossible. They're interwoven with this world in which we live, which is I mean, I don't know if we should go into that, but I think there are important differences between, say, the early 70s and the 20s, like this century that has passed. It has made things a lot worse, I feel. Not just me. I mean, we are in a genocidal moment, which is like fully approved by most governments. The huge challenges to the, you know, to the economy is experienced by the people, most people. We are in a war economy. There's like much more oppression. And even so, people who started out, like feminists who started out in the early 70s, I think what we call the second wave, I think they were able to be optimistic. In a way that I think we find it very difficult to die.
Do you think this optimism can be an element of the avant-garde legacy? Because when you said it, I thought immediately of Malevich being like, we're going to create new art and new world by that or with that. And I'm not sure if we can claim this kind of thing. I mean, if the artists can.
Well, it's hard because we see that for most people, for many people, for people to go even, you know, to vote, it is the radical right that leads them rather than what we would call the revolutionary left. I don't need to use the word radical because it doesn't mean something necessarily these days. So, I mean, as we speak, there are like mobilizations in France, for instance, against the terrible our economy that I think we all know.
We're
at least in Europe. And it's very hard for a movement to find its feet. I think Capital has so many that always brings up fascism, you know, as a kind of
a response to left. Yeah, response to replacements.
So nowadays a preemptive even response because left's not that strong. So I think Capital enjoys a level of hegemony that it wasn't like this in the 70s, even after McCarthyism. Yes, we had postmodernism, which was a counter-revolutionary movement, movement, but like cultural state, let's say, led by America. Yeah, absolutely. But this is something I discuss a lot.
I think this is a big discussion about postmodernism, precisely, because I'm kind of, I trust bell hooks, for instance, and other Black Studies scholars who are claiming that within this postmodern moment, they, meaning people representing minoritarian groups, they could access debates. While in earlier versions of the leftist narrative, also feminist narrative for that matter, they would be marginalized and excluded. So I think there was something on the level of form or within postmodernism that allows joining the minorities to join the leftist strands and discussions.
Women are not a minority. There's been a structural...
Yeah, but Black people are, for the matter.
And I think globally, certainly... so-called people of color are also not a minority. So we're talking about structural power that are quite complex. And Hal Foster did discuss, he was among those who said maybe we have a good postmodernism and a bad postmodernism.
Yep.
But even he wondered at the time, the mid-80s, when he was writing this in his book, Recordings, if I remember correctly, whether they're one and the same in the sense of the huge eclecticism and how they, I mean, postmodernism invented intersectionality, which for me is a very problematic term in the way.
Yes.
And Kimberly Crenshaw herself, she says in Footnote 9, I think, of the second article that she writes on this, that this was a connection to postmodernism. And if you look at intersectionality, it uses this kind of like flat space metaphor, which does not really allow for grasping the articulation, you know, the kind of like edifice of what does it mean? What does gender mean in relation to...
Yeah, but Kimberly,
for instance, and so on. So for me, I'm afraid I belong to those who want to see a new critical lexicon and a reinstatement of a class that does not just put it in a mathematical formula that says gender, sexuality, race, which doesn't exist for science.
Exactly. It's not, it's an empty
concept class. And because I think this creates many complications. As I said, I read a whole book to try and argue differently. And I think that we need to depart in many ways from this certain particularities in the intellectual dominance of the US.
Absolutely. I think so. Yes. I think
that is at a certain moment in time. I think it's time for,
not that Europe didn't play a role. I mean, another thing started, and I would say also in what was Western Europe. And I think intellectual dominance of certain things had served openly.
Yeah. I think that the moment you are mentioning is the moment when François Lyotard announces, repeats basically after Adorno, the impossibility of, you know, making any artwork and also claiming to any specific discourse, right? He rejects this narrative of certainty for the and chooses the uncertainty. The problem is that he appropriates the trauma that Adorno genuinely had and Lyotard did not have, because in Parisian apartments, you know, of the 1970s, I'm sorry to say, but neither Lyotard nor Baudrillard, for that matter, who also makes certain claims for postmodernism, neither of them were experiencing the overwhelming trauma that crushes the European rationality. Adorno had that experience, and I give it to Adorno. You can say whatever you like after what you've experienced. But even though Adorno, I don't think he was postmodern. I think he had actually quite strong modernist core till the end. But when Lyotard comes in and sort of attaches himself to Adorno, but then rejects the differentiation of valid and not valid judgment, and therefore also all this concept of truth and factuality, which we need, and this historical materialist strength that you, I think, very brilliantly represent, makes very solid claims for it. I think we need to return to it. However, I would say that we need to learn also from this postmodern momentum. We need to learn about exclusions, about discriminatory elements, and all this, you know, additional elements, which for postmodernists themselves didn't maybe mean so much, but for us as like feminist, Marxist, and other critical thinkers, I think we mean the world. So I think that, for instance, when Kimberly Crenshaw built the intersectionality, she did it as a lawyer. She needed, you know, a metaphor which will allow in court to fight for the rights of the most excluded.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, so she her, I just finished the sentence. Her intersectionalism is very, very, very conditioned. It's not unconditional general ontology.
I think it's something useful for a particular kind of state in the history of trade unions,
yeah,
to be able to defend the undeniably greater exploitation, I would say, not just oppression. For instance, in the U.S. of African-American and basically non-white, you know, women in many cases.
Yeah.
So I can see the usefulness there. But what this theory is not, like, it's not a revolutionary theory. It accepts, it says, these are the companies, right? They're privately owned. I mean, this is taken for granted. How can we accommodate?
Mm-hmm.
How can I accommodate? How can we have kind of some gains or some recognition is there for certain workers, who can be actually a great number of workers.
But that's
live through this, you know, double exploitation, not just double oppression.
But listen, the avant-gardists, you know, the Maleviches of early 20th century and all the women that were also parts of the avant-garde, their claims were not based on resignation from the basic rights or from the factual rights, as I would call them, in opposition to like ideal or utopian rights. They never said, we want to reject our labor code rights in order to get utopia. We want the labor rights and we want the utopia. This is a wider statement. So I'm thinking, I'm practicing this thinking a lot, and I wonder what you think about it. For me, it's like, I want my utopia, but I want every single of the rights that I'm granted to still be granted to me, you know?
I'm not in support of the idea that says that we should let things get
really rotten so that the revolution happens. I abhor this idea. But what I see specifically, since our discussion is the avant-garde, what I see specifically in the art world, I think much more in visual performing arts than in literature, which is a different thing in many ways, is that the complicity and some kind of like stupid hope arises from that, from the belief that we can incrementally read something. No, we cannot. So absolutely, we need to keep fighting for labor rights, and not only, other forms of recognition as well. I mean, the kind of undermining of the rights of gay, lesbian, and Negro people, for instance, it should be a given. It should be a given that we shouldn't be having a discussion of the revel. These people, us, I don't know, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because I
think that we should only be having the arts discussion. Yeah. Like, what's the strategy?
But I think that what you said
is the horizon where there's claiming more and more rights, which we cannot claim because we're under attack all the time.
I think that in your statement, and a very important criticism of this optimism within art scene, which for me translates into thinking that we as a group of five are going to revolutionize the whole world by the fact that I'm Polish, you're Greek, and we have three people of color in our group. And this is the beginning and end of the revolution. No, it's not. The fact that we get to communicate, you know, me coming from Eastern Europe and growing up in a sense that Soviet revolution was oppressive for me, and you growing up in the thinking that it was the most emancipatory, and then I think in our conversations also changing those ideas and having wider understanding for what people in East and West Europe think of, or South Europe for that matter, but also gaining more comprehension. This is very important process. I think it's the core of democracy. It's like we come with different standpoints and we do learn new factors and new things without changing our general positions probably. But this is not the end of the political agenda, I think. For me, this is just the beginning. It's like, okay, I'm happy that I can connect with... Yeah.
Thinking about history, disagreeing about history, which is also transnational history, because the Greece where I grew up is certainly part of the October Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Like... the Greek states, like all the capitalist states, they sent armies to fight against the workers. So that is the situation. Then there were certain things that happened that, and so on. I mean, that should be another
whole conversation. Yeah. Listen, last question about the neo-avant-garde, because this is technically important for me. Do you use this notion? Do you use the notion of neo-avant-garde or not? And what do you think about it, basically?
Okay. I mean, the return of the real, the neo-avant-garde at the end of the century, Hal Foster's book of 1996, has been one of the most important one for me. I'm aware, of course, that Benjamin Buchler, and he also had a book just a little bit later, towards the end of the millennium, the century, the 20th century, there was a return, a kind of re-examination of what on earth happened between the beginning of the century, you know, the early 20th century and the end of the 20th century. So we have this scholarship, this very important critical scholarship that tries to make sense of the beginning and the end of the century. Because the end of the century was not good. The capture was huge. And some art historians very knowledgeably think and kind of very revolutionary in the thought in some ways, no matter where they were placed. They created a theory that could accommodate, I think, of the decline, the delegitimization, if you will, of the gradual delegitimization of the avant-garde within the institution, but also the weekend to retain something. So Foster at least looks at the new avant-garde of the 50s and 60s, even differentiates between the 50s and 60s.
he sees that the artists use pretty much the same mechanisms, the same techniques, if you will, but they use them in a different way. I mean, you mentioned Martha Rosler, and I think that with your Bringing the War Home series, like Avius Collins, for instance, that's a very interesting and a very necessary, meaningful
intervention,
of Collins, just to give an example. And I think you can call it neo-avant-garde because it's nothing better to call it, you know, to show that there is actually a very serious political cause, an anti-imperialist, perhaps, a critique of imperialism, you know, at the time, from people and from artists like, and theorists, because also theorists like Martha Rosler, that needs to be talked about.
Yep.
But I think it wasn't easy for this generation of art historians to not go to form in the end. I don't think all the artists discussed, like in The Return of the Real, for me, can be connected with a new avant-garde in terms of political judgment.
Yeah, I think that in the context of new avant-garde, there is this condition that the work contains irony, which earlier was not present. This is one of the claims that Foster makes. And I'm rethinking that because I think Martha Rosler is not ironic, really. She can be sarcastic. She can make jokes. She has sense of humor, yes. But she's very authentic in what she is about. So I think she has this sincerity. So I'm trying, like, you know, when I'm trying to think about weak avant-garde and sort of differentiate between my standpoint and this new avant-garde standpoint, this is one element. It's like, I think Martha Rosler has this, you know, this sincere approach, which I think is very typical for feminist artists who were always about something and very sincerely. So even if they were making jokes, they were not the same irony as the male artists would use, who would basically make a mockery out of certain art forms, certain political ideas, certain audiences, certain themselves sometimes. Yeah. And then there come feminist artists and they are more connected, more serious about things. And
I think irony was very present. It had to be very present for artists who artists on the left at the time, very much on the left, because they could see what was going on. At the same time, there was no critical, this was not a revolutionary moment. So to survive, if you will, you have to turn to a degree of irony, reflecting on your situation, which is also the social situation.
Yeah.
And I think the question of irony is not, of course, the same as cynicism. I mean, Friedrich Jameson was able to perceive it without, of course, referring to a new avant-garde, I think, at the moment, you know, he was theorizing postmodernism, but he was trying to steep postmodernism also as a very, very serious critical moment. Having read a lot of both Foster and Ibsen and Martha Rosler's work, I mean, her writings, I think they were all part of
the same current.
They were rebelling against a level of capitalist strategy that was all-consuming at the time. It was huge. And I'm glad that some people like them, they retained their oppositionality, the critical oppositionality, and that they were not so depressed.
Yeah.
And they carried on kind of breaking through, you know, with works that we can now
reflect upon. Yeah. Look
back at this work and say, wow, I mean, and I wonder if somebody could make right now, because now we have a new level of censorship that takes us back to McCarthyism brings us, whether somebody could be making works like Martha Rosler's
today.
The current works, and where would work about Gaza like this be shown now?
Yeah. Not in Germany. I'm here in Berlin now, and we cannot speak about it. Yeah. Listen, I'm going to finish the recording for now. Thank you so very much for this conversation, and I hope we will continue in this podcast or in some other place. So thank you so very much.